Good morning to each one. Greet you in Jesus' name. I would welcome some people back or whatever, but they may have been here last Sunday when I wasn't, so then I might get welcome back, so I'll just be quiet on that one. I did want to say, by the way, that if I skip over the front benches, it looks really good, so I'll just do that and mentally skip over them, and thank you all for that. I guess you weren't here a couple, was it 2 weeks ago when I preached? I was coerced them to sit up for some of you. So anyways, I appreciate that effort that you put into that. In case you wonder why I'm preaching again, be with a schedule, somebody was going to have to get some extra turns, and Jason is a very gracious deacon to have around. I guess historically we work our deacons harder than some people do. And I had my brother, Jason, he says it's all good, it's fine, he'll do whatever. And then I have a brother that I was with last weekend, and he told me last week, he said, yeah, he said deacons are such overworked people, and he was lamenting how tough they have it. So I guess it's my way of trying to make Jason's life easier and hope you can put up with it. I didn't know Brian was going to sing children's songs. I almost had him sing this one for me. Well, I don't know. This message is not sure time-wise, but it's not that deep of one. Maybe we'll just break it up for the children some more. I hope you all know the song "When We All Pull Together." How many of you know that song? I think, why don't we stand and sing it? It's "When We All Pull Together" is the first verse. "When we all sing together, when we all pray together, when we all read together."
When we all pull together, when we all pull together, how happy we'll be. When your song is my work and our work is God's work, when we all pull together, how happy we'll be. When we all sing together, when we all sing together, how happy we'll be. When your song is my song and our song is God's song, when we all sing together, how happy we'll be. When we all pray together, when we all pray together, how happy we'll be. When your prayer is my prayer and our prayer is God's prayer, when we all pray together, how happy we'll be. When we all read together, when we all read together, how happy we'll be. When your book is my book and our book is God's book, when we all read together, how happy we'll be.
Thank you. You can be seated. Okay, I like to do this at home. I'm not sure the people that I do it to enjoy it as much as I do. And that is try to see how well people's memories work. Last Sunday evening, I shared at a place I hadn't preached. I think I was there 5 years ago. And the one brother came and told me what I preached about. And to be honest with you, he asked me, and I had memory problems too, so I had just to admit my memory problem. So I don't know, but I thought I wouldn't try 5 years on you, but I thought I would try 2 weeks. For those of you that were here, can you tell me what we talked about that day? What I talked about, I guess. Okay, thank you. So we called that. Does anybody remember what commandment we called that? I guess there was two adjectives, actually, if I remember correctly myself. Okay, the first great commandment. Okay. I understand that a young lady told her father, I hope I got this story right, that he should try to preach the same message every time he preaches to see if the church gets tired of it and lets him quit preaching. That wasn't somebody in my house, it was somebody else. And so I thought maybe I would try that, actually, not really. But I'm going to use the same text. If you want to open your Bibles to Mark chapter 12, I'm going to use the exact same text I did 2 weeks ago and hope to see what you do with me here. We could give this thing a lot of different titles, and I hope it's not exactly the same as 2 weeks ago. I'll look at a little bit different twist, but I'd still like to read these same verses as my text. I think I called that applying the first commandment. I guess we could just keep it simple, call this applying the second commandment. Mark chapter 12, verse 28. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, and perceiving that he had answered them well, speaking of Christ, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength, and this is the first commandment. The second is like, or similar to it, namely this, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these. And the scribe said unto him, Well, master, thou hast said the truth. For there is but one, there is one God, and there is none other but he. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself is more than the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly or wisely, he said unto him, Thou art not far from the kingdom of God. And no man after that durst ask him any questions. Okay. So, in that subject, I focus primarily on the first commandment, loving the Lord with all our mind, with all our soul, with all our strength. This time, I'd like to focus on the second, loving our neighbor. If you remember, I told you, I used the illustration of a human comparison. Told you if I would, thinking of a friend that's far away, so I used Joel Schrock as that friend, one of my friends that's far away. I ask you, how do I show love for him? Do y'all remember how we showed love for him? Anyone?
Loving his loved one.
Okay, that was one, and then there was another way we could do it as well.
Communication.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so the first one was through remembering him and taking time for him. Text, calls, emails, cards, letters, prayer, support, and travel. Okay, and then the second one was the one Michael mentioned, by caring for those he cares about. And I used the illustration of his dad being here this spring. So I told you then that the first commandment ties directly, or should I say the second ties directly into the first, or brings the second, which is similar, equal to our association with, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I'm not quite certain myself, but if we would turn to Luke chapter 10, you don't necessarily need to do that. But we have we actually have the scribe in this case saying the commandment rather than Christ. And then he goes on and Jesus tells him, well, to do that. And the scribe responds, well, who is my neighbor? And then Jesus goes on and gives the story of what we call the Good Samaritan. And so I'm bringing that in because that clearly shows us who our neighbor is, that story. I'm not going to go read that story, but our neighbor is anyone God brings into our path that we have opportunity to either do good for or neglect, I feel, as anybody. So if you walk across my path and you have a need that I can either fill or turn my back to, you are my neighbor. You are my responsibility, in other words. And so some of these verses will use the word neighbor. Some will use the word brother. To me, I think they're interchangeable. If God has brought anyone into your life and you have the opportunity to do good, you face the choice to whether you're going to do good or not. That person is your neighbor or your brother, so to speak. So that's the premise that I'm using for this, and I hope you can support that. Okay, before I get into the next part of this, I'd like to just read 1 John chapter 4, verse 20. Listen closely. If a man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, or like I said, his neighbor, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother, whom he hath seen, then he asks the question, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? So if I say, I don't love this person that God brought into my path, he's saying that for me to turn around and say, God, I love you, I praise you, I worship you, is a lie. Now, do you really believe that? For me to say, oh no, I can't help that situation. I can't relate to that person. They're just too bad. I'm going to cut them off. But I turn around and say, God, I love you and I praise you and I'm your child. He says, that's a liar. He says, if I can't love the person I've seen, how can I love God whom I've not seen? Okay, so keep that in your mind. Now for stories. Wasn't sure this might end up being more of a children's class than a sermon, but I guess children won't care. So, I'd like to tell you about two islands. Can someone of the school children tell me what an island is? Anyone? What's an island? How would you define an island? You want to try, Kara? Okay, that's pretty good. An island is a piece. Is land that's totally surrounded by water. You can't usually drive very far. It depends how big they are. If they get real big, we call them continents. So I want to talk about two islands. The one is about the size of Jonesboro. I don't know how many of you have driven the breadth and length of Jonesboro city limits. A few of us have, so that kind of gives us an idea. The other one is much smaller. It's about the size of it's about 106 acres, so it's a small farm. So the first island I want to talk about is called Easter Island, and it's off the coast of Chile. It's actually part of the country of Chile, South America. Now this island is unique. Well, I shouldn't say it's unique. There's some others that are close, but I think it's one of the furthest away from any other island or continent. It is 1,289 miles from the closest inhabited land, which is another island with a couple people on it. So it's not very close. So if you need help or anything, you are a long, long, long ways, a long trip. Even today, that takes a bit of time. So 1,289 miles from the closest inhabited island. If you want to go to the nearest continent where you can drive your car around for quite a ways, it's South America, and that's 2,182 miles. So that's a really long trip. So that's where Easter Island is. Now, Easter Island covers 63.17 square miles. To put that into acres, that's 40,429 acres. I think Jonesboro is 80 square miles, roughly, so it's a little bit smaller than Jonesboro city limits. And at its peak, there was 15,000 people living on this island. 15,000 people, so that's like 30% again of Batesville living inside this. So if you divide the land, how much acres there was per person, you end up with 2.7 acres per person. So it wasn't just crowded, but neither was it just a desert. There was plenty of people on this island. These people were called, and I'm not sure if I can speak their language, so if I pronounce this wrong, I guess we'll just have to live with me. Best I can say their name, these people were called Rapa Nui. Rapa Nui. Now these people were really industrious. They built a thriving culture here. And they had quite a few of accomplishments. For example, Easter Island, being so far out in the ocean, gets some tremendous winds. And so to plant their crops, they would actually roll big stones around and plant their crops behind the stones so that the wind wouldn't blow them over. So it wasn't that these were dumb people at all. They did some other stuff. They had a very good system of making mulch out of seabird droppings and that kind of thing. And they did some real good farming things. They had actually... They like their chickens better than I like chickens. It says that they actually made, chicken coops. They made chicken coops out of solid rock, so they worked pretty hard for their chickens. But anyway, that's a few of the things. Now, the one thing they did that they're really known for today, if anybody knows anything about Easter Island, and the reason people go there, is to see what they call Moai. I'm not used to that many vowels in a word. It's M-O-A-I. Moai. Does anybody want to know what a moai is? Okay. So I don't know. I don't decide how to set up. That's these huge statues. So that's, you've probably seen pictures. If you look at history books or anything in South America, they're fairly common. And the moai looks like some huge idols or something to me, but anyways. So they would build these great big things. Now, to give you an idea of how, shall we say, advanced these people actually were, like I told you, they weren't stupid. The biggest one that they moved, they would move these things out to their seacoast, and then they would turn them around with their backs to the ocean looking inland. They thought, they're not quite sure why they did all this stuff, but they would move these things up to, I don't know exactly, but 3 miles is what I found one place. From where they took them out of the rock, they quarried them out and moved them up to 3 miles to where they would be set up. The biggest one that they moved was 33 feet tall and weighed 90 tons. Now, that's the biggest one they moved, and they didn't have any cat excavators or dump trucks or anything to move this thing. In fact, they're still trying to figure out how they moved it, but I don't know. No use going into that. Now, they were working on one that was quite a bit bigger. I don't know if they had a plan on moving this thing or not. They didn't get this one done, but they were working on one in the quarry there that was 69 feet tall and weighed 300 tons. Now, they didn't just do one or two of these things. I'm not sure, they're not all standing, but there's pieces out along the coast, like away a distance from the quarry, they have pieces of 887 of these statues. So this was a pretty serious hobby. It wasn't like did one or two and decide that was too much work. No, it was a big deal. So they had 887 of these huge statues they called Moai. They cut them out of the rock, would move them however they did it. Speculation is that they used logs. They would cut down trees and use a section just like we would use a pipe or something today to slide a mini barn around, and rolled them somehow. That's the best, at least one of the theories. So that's, they could do something out. Now, these people were capable of, should we say, a huge feat, because if you told me to move even the smaller one there, the 33 foot tall, 90 ton thing without breaking it, I don't know if I could even do it with equipment. I imagine there's some people that could, but I don't think I could. So they had some real accomplishments, but something happened. We're not totally sure on the sequence or another what order this happened, but that civilization went from 15,000 at its peak to around, let's say, 2,500 in about 100 years. So that's a lot of people just population-wise just dropping off. In 1722, when the Europeans came, they were down to 2,000 or 3,000. So now they had a few problems on this island. Where they made these big things. They had rats and lots of rats. They had another problem is that they used all their trees up. There were no trees left. And another problem is they had eaten all the birds. All the birds that came to that island were extinct. They had basically killed all of them. And another thing was they had neglected their agriculture. They had quit their farming like I told you they used to. And then the other thing was they started fighting. Families would decide that they didn't get along with this family, and then they would fight. So it doesn't really matter what occurred first. Regardless of what occurred, this population went from 15,000 to 2,500 in a matter of, like I said, less than 100 years. And then in that time, they actually got down to 111 because of some other things. It was the Europeans' fault. But regardless of what occurred, you know what happened? There's four things that I see happening with these people. Seemingly small things, like rats, for example, were neglected for big and important things like these statues. Yet the small things contributed to the destruction of the civilization. I want you to think about that. It was so important for these people, and we're not sure today exactly why, but it was so important that every family, every clan, every somebody have this big statue representing them standing there, that they let the rats take over while they went out and carved their statue out of the rock. So how about that? They left the small things, seemingly small things, were neglected for the big and important. The second thing they did, the resources were used for personal and family advancement with resulting destruction to all. So now I told you that this island was 1,289 miles away from the other closest island with people on it. So what they think happened is that these people used up all their trees to move these statues, that when the famine hit, there was no trees left to build a boat to even go for help. That's what they think. So they used the resources for personal and family advancement to make themselves feel big, is a simple way of saying it. They neglected the very important for the trivial. And what I mean by that is agriculture is what you eat, right? Raising plants. And pest control is also very important. You let the rats take over, they take over and eat the food that there's left. So they left agriculture and pest control. They lost sight of that because they wanted to promote their ego. And the fourth thing they did is they lost sight of a common and greater goal of life, for the lesser and fleeting goal of self-exaltation. It was much more important to have a big idol out there, or whatever you want to call that thing, to make me and my family look important than it was to take care of the fields. Okay, that was Easter Island, and I'll let you think about that. Now I want to tell you about another island. I'm fairly sure you haven't heard of this one if you haven't heard of Easter Island. I don't really know what picture, so I just got an aerial view of the island. This island here is called Anuta. It's part of the Solomon Islands. It's approximately 850 yards across, which is, shall we say, half a mile. Not very wide. You don't have a lot of place to wiggle around on this island. 850 yards across. They're, of course, not sure, but they think there's around 15 generations have lived on this island now. So generation being 20 years, you can do the math. Goes back a couple hundred years. Now, what's interesting about this island is it's 106 acres. I think that's when the tide is high. So that's they got up. No, excuse me, 91. 106 is maybe when the tide's out, but it's fairly small. It's 91 acres in the clear. Now, on this island, as of today, roughly there is 300 people living on this island of 91 acres. But anyway, let's see, where was my math on that one? That lets over 3 people per acre, like 3.3 people per acre. So it's fairly dense. In fact, they say it's one of the most densely settled areas in the world. Now, this island is it's not quite as far. It's 70 miles from another inhabited island, which is also a very small one, only a couple people on that one. It's a little further to some bigger islands. It's part of the Solomon Islands. Let's see, it's 1,491 miles from Australia, this one is. But now these people on this island, like I said, 15 generations, they had some problems in the beginning, but for the last 10 generations, they've been fairly stable, settled from what they can tell. But there's no big statues on this island. In fact, there's a couple grass huts. The pictures I've seen, they're very... No stone buildings, no nothing, very that important looking. But they have one thing on this island, and I'm not trying to make these people Christian necessarily, but they do have one thing on this island that is very important. And that is what shall we call a concept or an idea. And they call this concept or idea Arapa. Excuse me. Arapo is A-R-O-P-A. Arapo is an idea or concept that emphasizes collaboration, sharing, and compassion for others. The concept of Arapo encourages Anutans to share their finite resources equitably, which means peacefully and willingly. Arapo means that what I do is done for all, what I have is available to all, a sacrificing of the personal preference and or good for the collective or overall good. Even though technically on this island, I shouldn't say there are no laws, they are part of the Solomon Island, but this island itself really is governed by, doesn't really have a rule of law. As far as I know, they don't have any policemen or game wardens. Yet, it's interesting that certain times of the year, the 300 people that live on this island will not fish for certain kinds of fish. And that certain times of the year, they will not kill just anything they can because they know that they have to save up for later. They contribute what they can. So in other words, if I catch a fish, I share my fish with the whole village. And they together work on having an emergency food source secured. In other words, the highest point on this island is about 200 feet above sea level. And so what they will do is they'll dry their fish, they'll get their food, and what they can store, they'll take up way up on a mountain to survive basically in the Pacific there. It's not called a hurricane, but it'd be the same thing, cyclone. And in fact, within modern history, the Solomon Islands got hit by a very bad cyclone, yet these people were actually ready for it, more than the people that should have been ready for it, because they worked together and they saved this up. Now, there's four reasons that these people can live on this island this way. that I have, and that the first one is they're willing to lay aside personal agenda and preference. Number two, the sources they have are shared for all. They're there for everybody to benefit equally, or at least mostly so. Third one is they're willing to forego instant gratification for the long-term security. In other words, just because they catch a fish doesn't mean that they eat a fish right away. That fish may be going to another family. It may be dried for their cache up on the mountain. Four, they focus on and work together on the common goal of survival. Now, if these people, they do have some canoes, but they really don't venture far. They hardly ever go to the other islands. And so when they fish, one way that they fish is the whole village gets together, and the tall people wade out in the water further than the short people, and they make a big circle out, and then they have these little bamboo cane thingies, and they'll splash them, and they herd the fish up into a center where they can catch them with small nets. And see, that's how they work together. Everybody plays a role, everybody does their part, even though that varies with individual and with responsibility. So I want you to remember Easter Island and Anuta Island, because I want to draw a few lessons from them as I continue on with Scripture here. Actually, maybe I should tell you about the two people first. So let me talk about two people. It's been a number of years now, but one time a brother from a church far away was talking to me about a man we mutually knew. And he told me that this man he was talking about, he said he was raised to be an independent mountain man, is how he described him. So I called my first man of the two people the mountain man. Nothing against true mountain men. But this fellow could have a host of names. We could call him, and nothing, not to do this disparagingly at anyone, but we could call him the Mennonite. We could call him the Amish. We could call him the Methodist. We could call him the conservative. We could call him the liberal. We could call him the traditional. We could call him the anti-traditional, and I could keep going. You could give lots of names to this fellow. But this fellow has lots of thoughts, ideas, ideals, goals, and even convictions. He can wax very eloquent about his point of view and argue incessantly and convincingly about the truth of his position. And for some of these fellows, it's hard to mention an idea or give a suggestion that they haven't covered in some way. They have a plan and a thought for anything that comes up. This fellow knows exactly where he's going and what he's doing, or at least he thinks he does. But often if you watch these fellows, something happens to them. They may become absorbed with the nuance, with some small nuance or difference. And when you see them do that, soon they're taking and are creating sides on issues and with people. Pretty soon, if they keep going, they can't stand so-and-so. They don't have any use for brother so-and-so because he thinks this way, and I just don't like his ideas. They become preoccupied with setting up their thoughts and ideas and sacrifice the good of all for what they consider the wiser course they see. And in reality, they're just setting up big stone idols, except they're not stone. They become willing to divide and destroy to protect their deep insight and wisdom. And I'm going to give you an illustration. I was trying to think of a good illustration. I'm not in any way accusing the other brother involved in this conversation of doing this. But I thought of how easily it can happen. Back here, didn't really count up. But when we're talking about the veiling application, there was a few of us that got into a conversation about whether a church should have variation in veilings or whether it should all have one type, okay? Seemed that some people had some pretty strong feelings about it, and I probably, to be honest, was one of them. And the one side would kind of focus on unity and on doing things together. The other side would focus on being open and some things like that. And you know, as I was thinking back about that, I thought, something, isn't it how quickly you can kind of become dogmatic about your point of view when really what you're basing it on is not really, can I say, clear biblical principles. It's more the way I grew up, what I like. Yeah, that kind of thing. Now, I want to be careful here I think we do have to stand with true biblical principle. At the same time, how many divisions occur for less than clear principles? I wasn't sure where to put this in. But as human beings, sometimes we reach a place where, at least to me, principles look at odd with each other. Have you ever been at such a place? And I'll give you an illustration of this. This was from a brother far away from here. But he said one time, he said, as he studies God's word, and I'm not trying to just pick this issue because of any feelings that are here. I just is the one that come to my mind as I thought about this. But there was He said as he works with couples and situations, there's times that a divorced and remarried couple, from his human perspective, looks like they should stay together. We were talking about David and Michael in our Sunday school lesson, right? And whatever was right or wrong in their situation, he said today it looks to him sometimes like, just let it go. They have a good home. The children are doing well. Just let it. But he said at the same time, biblical principles indicate that that's not a marriage that God can bless. So we have to stand with the Bible in that teaching. At the same time, there is so many times that we part ways over things that are so trivial, so small, that it's really embarrassing. If you do a research on Mennonite history, it's actually almost depressing when you look at the divisions that occurred and as to what actually triggered them. So I want to be clear. Whenever the Bible is clear, is it divorce and remarriage? Is it the headship veiling? Is it non-resistance? All those things, I think we have to stand with truth. Absolutely. Don't take me wrong at all. At the same time, if it's merely an application that I prefer and that I'm trying to force into the Bible because that's really what I want, I think if you look historically at the tradition, what's happened traditionally is that we sacrifice the way of love for my way. And I'm not trying to say that in a judgmental way, but I think I see that tendency all too easily in my own life. And as I look at history, I don't think I'm the first one to maybe struggle with that. So just my personal conviction, and I'd like to, maybe if you disagree with me, correct me. But I feel that on what the Bible clearly states, I have to clearly stay with. But on those applications, yes, I might have a very strong preference, but I have to sacrifice those preferences to the principle of love. I'm actually going the wrong way. Now, that said, I guess if it's something that you feel very strong about, there's maybe a place for you to go find a church that does it the way you feel, in a good, kind, loving way where you're not slandering and all that. I'm not going to take that away from someone. At the same time, if there's conflict, unless it's a clear biblical principle, I had better yield or find a place where I can serve God and feel that that's being honored. Let me just read a verse out of 1 Corinthians 3:3. It says this, and this is Paul talking to the Corinthian church, and we kind of, at least in my mind, the more I study 1 Corinthians, like, wow, what a church. At the same time, they were struggling, but this doesn't sound familiar at all. It says, for ye are yet carnal, whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions. Are ye not carnal and walk as men? You know, that's not really a verse that's extremely popular in our culture because, well, we say, yeah, sure, envying and strife. Well, maybe strife. We try to avoid that. But divisions? Paul says divisions come from carnality for the most part. Galatians chapter 5, verse 13 through 15 says this, for brethren, ye have been called unto liberty. Oh, that's a verse we can hang on to today, right? Liberty. Only, he says, use not liberty for occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But then he goes on and says, but if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. Wow. I have to think of I think it was a poem in a reader when I was in school about the calico cat and the gingham dog side by side on the table sat. Remember, anybody remember that? Anyway, I can't quote the whole poem, but the clock struck 12 or whatever it was, and there was nobody around, but the dog and the cat got in some kind of argument. And when morning came, abridging this rather rapidly, there was nothing left but a few pieces of calico and gingham. Yet how often doesn't that happen with people that claim to be God's children? Can I really do that if I love my neighbor as myself? The second person I want to tell you about is I'm going to merely call him the Christian. And I see the Christian as a simple and straightforward man. He's not evasive of standing with the truth and principles of the truth, like I told you. Yet even in this, he does it in such a way that you know he's standing where he does on an issue because of truth, and he's not doing it for some personal agenda or to reject or condemn others. On any other issue or subject that is not directly linked to the principles of truth, even where he has a strong personal preference or where he finds it most comfortable, you will find him willing to work with and support a different view. In fact, you'll find this person willing to go the second mile in keeping peace and being a blessing to others. And if he doesn't feel he can support, he'll do what he needs to put himself in a different place rather than causing division. You know, if he has a question or a concern about somebody in the church or about an issue in the church, it's not that he doesn't share it. It's not that he's not open with it. Yet at the same time, when it's not clear Bible principle, he will support a different view. You know, if he has a liberty he enjoys, yet he sees that this liberty brings a stumbling block to his brother or sister, he will voluntarily forego his liberty to ensure continued health and spiritual safety of his brother. He lives his life by this mantra, or command we could call it, Romans 15:1-7. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. In other words, the neighbor's good. For even Christ pleased not himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of them that reproach thee fell on me. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. Now the God of patience and consolation grant you to be like-minded one toward another according to Christ Jesus, that you may with one mind and with one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Wherefore, receive ye one another, as Christ also received us to the glory of God. I guess there was a few phrases here that stood out to me. The first one was, not to please myself. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but whenever I strongly disagree with somebody, I usually feel like they're the weak one. Do y'all ever have that feeling at all? They're the one that could see it a bit different, right? Well, if that's the case, then he makes it pretty clear who's supposed to give up, doesn't he? If you feel like you're the strong one, you're supposed to give in to the weak. And then the next one was, let everyone please his neighbor for his good edification, or shall I say benefit. You know, as I look at the Christian, as I'm using him here, his thought is, how will this decision, the decision I'm about to make, or the example I will be in this area, affect my brother? Will it hinder his walk with God? Will it help him live a more consistent life with God? And then it goes on and gives Christ as a perfect example. Now, Christ was not necessarily just a snuggly blanket, was he, to the Pharisees and stuff? He sometimes told them the truth. I had to think of the verse in Proverbs where he says, open rebuke is better than secret love. I'm not trying to indicate that a true Christian does not challenge, does not at some times approach a need in someone else's life. At the same time, as he does that, he will do it as Christ did and offer a way, a solution, a help, and an example. Romans 13:7-10 says, render therefore to all their dues. So you got debts to pay whether you knew it or not. It says, tribute to whom tribute. Well, probably most of us have done that or we wouldn't be here. They come take care of that, right? Okay. So you're supposed to pay your taxes. Custom to whom custom. Wow, I don't know if I like that one so well. Tradition to whom tradition. What does that mean? Anyway, custom to whom custom. A little bit more stressful sometimes. Let's see, now I got lost in my... Then it says, fear to whom fear, and I take that as respect to rulers, to those in authority. Then he says, honor to whom honor, which is kind of building on that thought. Then he says, owe no man anything, but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. So did you know that every last one of you here is in debt? Now I'm not talking about your checkbook. I'm talking about the debt of love you owe. Christ has loved us all more than what we can ever love him or anyone else. So we have a debt of love to pay. And yes, we do owe our love to God. He does want us to love him with our whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. At the same time, like I told you in that message 2 weeks ago, I predominantly do that by loving those he's put around me in a godly way. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. So in a way, he says we have liberty to live outside of the law if you want to, but actually above the law. Because when we love, we are free from the law because we are now living above the law. He goes on and says, for this, or because of love, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. Let me read that in a different way. For this, or because of love, you shall not commit adultery because you love your neighbor. You will not kill because you love your neighbor. You will not steal because you love your neighbor. You will not bear false witness because you love your neighbor. You will not covet what your neighbor has because you love your neighbor. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended or included in this saying, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Then he ends up by saying, love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. So what are you rendering, or we would say giving to others? Are you paying a debt? And you know, there's some debts that if you have a monetary debt, most of us that have or have had those look forward to the day we get them paid off. But you know, this is one that doesn't get paid off. You wake up every morning, you owe exactly the same amount you did when you went to bed. Or maybe more, I'm not sure how to classify that. So are you paying your debt? Is that balance increasing or decreasing? Well, I just said you don't really decrease it. But, you know, are you at least doing it every day? And then notice how love for my neighbor keeps me from all these things. And I was kind of struck by that personally, especially that maybe some of these more so than others. Evidently, if you really love your neighbor, to kill somebody, they have to cross your path, right? So it's fairly evident if you love them, you're not going to kill them. That, I could kind of get that. But how about purity? You know, I cannot love while lusting. That's impossible. Love and lust can't come from the same heart. How about that? Or maybe I skip stealing. Well, I could kind of see that. He worked hard. I take it. Yeah, okay. That's loving your neighbor. Well, what about this next one is maybe the one that really got me. False witness. Now, I don't know. To me, a false witness goes much more than just going to court and giving a false story to try to get somebody into prison. You know, it would be included in a lot of things. How about vain imaginations? Imagining that, and I touched on that a little bit 2 weeks ago, but imagining that brother or sister so-and-so has it in for me because they didn't talk to me a couple weeks. Or how about that? Or how about gossip? Just passing on a needless story about somebody. The person I'm sharing with really has no responsibility and is not really going to help the other person with it. But, you know, that's kind of neat to tell them that. Isn't that a false witness? And this goes on and on. I have even seen, and I maybe have done it myself, I hope if I have that people and God can forgive me, but I've even seen people do this in a way that kind of sharing a prayer request, really. Oh, come on. If you're that concerned about them, fall down on your knees and pray about it. You don't have to talk to somebody else. I think that's a pretty serious one for myself. I'll let you decide that for yourself. And then he also has coveting, which also can hit a bit hard. He says, I cannot love while I desire what another one has. You know, to be honest with you, sometimes I think we probably all do this, regardless of where we're at in life, as we look at somebody else. Maybe it's finances, maybe it's a vehicle, maybe it's their family, their children just behave better than mine. You know, you could go on and on like, oh, if only, that'd be so nice to be them in that whatever area you pick. But you know what? As long as I'm desiring in a wrong way what somebody else has, it's not saying that you can't be blessed to see them blessed, but when I really let that active thing take hold in my life to where it's making me a little bit that I just wish I could have what that person has. You know, I can't love. And if I can't love my brother, what have we just looped back around to that I can't love God? And I thought I'd share this yet. I was talking with a brother from a different community, and he was He likes to think, and he's kind of like me. He had his hobby horse, I guess I would call it. And he was, that one weekend I spent with him, he was all over this subject. Kept talking about what makes or should make our churches the true or unique. What should be unique about our churches as they're after what Christ wants. And he was pounding away on this thing of community, community, community. And I almost smiled a little bit in my mind at least and thought, well, I guess he's got a hobby like I do. But the more I thought about it, the more I'm not so sure he wasn't pretty well on. And it depends what you want to classify as community as. But if we're thinking of the brotherhood, some people might say it's submission to each other. And I would say a big part of it is the love we have for each other. Isn't that what makes the true Church of Christ unique in the world today? Isn't that actually what Christ says is to attract people to the church? Is the love that we have for each other? And if we truly have a love for each other, doesn't that build a community of Christian believers in the world today? That brings security, help, and comfort in a way nothing else can. Let me just read John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, a verse I've shared with you many times. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. 1 John 4, verse 21. And this commandment, or maybe I can say test here, have we from him, from God, that he who loveth God love his brother also. Going back now to these stories, while these cultures don't necessarily were either Christian, I'm not trying to make one Christian, none Christian. Which way am I operating? Am I trying to build myself a great big stone thing so everybody knows who I am and they'll remember me? So am I living like a Rapa Nui, a carnal man? Or am I living as an Anutan, a new man in Christ, the one that does what he does for the good of all? Let's kneel for prayer.